Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, you all right over there?
Yeah. I'm a little Flemish this morning. Great morning. Today we got mentioned, Stage Left got mentioned in the New York Times.
Yeah, very nice.
Not the Jersey section of the New York Times, but the actual food section. A big thank you to Florence Fabricant, who did a wonderful article on restaurants being green. So restaurants that are ecologically responsible, and it was a survey of a whole bunch of things. And she mentioned how we put up our own fruits in the summertime. She didn't mention our solar panels, though, but that's okay. We like anything, as long as they spell the name right. And, they did spell the, and you know what? Even if they spelled the name a little wrong, as long as you can find us. So big fame for our restaurant, Stage Left, today and time. We're happy about that. And we're also happy about Valentine's Day.
What's not to be happy? It's Valentine's
Day. Especially if you own a restaurant.
Valentine's Day is one of those crazy, crazy days in the restaurant business where, you know, even a restaurant that wouldn't normally be booked on a Thursday night is booked a month in advance, is booked 3 weeks in advance. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's booked, but it's fun. It's a funny night. It's a very difficult night for restaurant staffs because you think, oh, well, they're busy. It's very profitable. And, you know, I'm not complaining about the night. I love Valentine's Day. But it's funny. It's what we call deuced to death.
Mm-hmm.
And a deuce is restaurant jargon for a table for two. And every table is a table for two, which really cuts down the efficiency. You have a lot of tables.
Sure. Most restaurants are set up to have, you know, I was in a restaurant the other night that was mostly sixes and fours.
Yeah.
So does that restaurant do on Valentine's Day?
It seats a lot of parties for two on tables for six.
It seats a lot of tables for two that where they would normally put six people.
Well, but the other interesting thing about the restaurant business that you may not realize is that it's very hard on the kitchen. Because if a kitchen turns out 200 dinners in the course of a busy night, say a Saturday night where a kitchen turns out 200 dinners, well, it turns out those 200 dinners, some of them are in parties of two, some of them are in parties of four, some in parties of six and eight. So for 200 parties for 200 dinners, you probably have about 50 checks on the board, 50 individual tickets that a kitchen has to cook.
And on a check, there'll be grouping of certain foods. I mean, some people will have three steaks on one table.
200 dinners on Valentine's Day is 100 individual checks.
Right.
And that is, it's quite a thing to keep track of in the back. We really have our A people in the back of every restaurant that isn't around, but ours certainly, to keep track of what goes on. But Valentine's Day, it's a day where it can be a very romantic day. It can be a very nice thing. It can also be kind of cheesy.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I think we should review cheesy. I think we should play the game cheesy, not cheesy.
All right, I'm in.
Champagne.
Not cheesy.
All right, I'm in.
Hold on.
Go ahead.
Champagne with a plastic stopper.
Incorrect. Must actually have cork. I'm sorry. Okay. Roses.
Depends.
Okay. A dozen roses at your house before you go to dinner.
Not cheesy.
Okay. Even better, a single rose that you've called ahead for and had laying on the table waiting for you to arrive.
Not cheesy.
The restaurant gives out a rose to every woman that comes in that day.
Cheesy.
Sorry. Sorry, guys. You get no credit for that one. That's just included. Okay, let's go on to...
That's just included.
That's it. You get no point. It's kind of nice. They'll take it, but you don't get any point. It's not bad, but you don't get any points. The restaurant might get a point for that. But actually, when you're like, you know what? It's funny. It's like going to those catering halls that do like five weddings at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Today is your special day. And her special
Here's
day.
Here's a rose.
And her
Here's
special
a rose.
Day.
Here's a rose. Here's a rose. Here's a rose.
Okay.
Here's another rose.
Let's move on to
Here's
chocolate.
A rose for you.
Let's
One more rose. Almost done with roses.
Let's move on to
Last
chocolate.
Rose.
Okay. Let's move on to chocolates. Chocolates, cheesy or not cheesy?
Again, I'm going to say depends.
Okay. Whitman Sampler.
Cheesy.
Heart-shaped box of chocolates from Jacques Torres in New York.
Not cheesy.
All right. There you go.
I think you can basically... here's a rule that I'm gonna tell everyone to go with. Any chocolate that you can buy in the supermarket, cheesy.
Okay, hold on a second. But here's one. But you don't need to spend a lot of money. You bake brownies at home for her that you surprise her with.
Are they iced or not iced?
Whatever. But that's not cheesy, right?
Not cheesy.
I think not cheesy.
Home-baked goods are not cheesy.
If you bake them, if you home-baked goods that you have your secretary bake, cheesy.
Right? Or
she doesn't know about them.
Right.
Okay. What else do we have? Roses. Here's another thing on roses. Roses come in different colors. I also think that the dozen red roses on Valentine's Day. Look, we hear them advertised all the time. For, you know, you can get them cheap on go with another flower. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, does she have a favorite flower? Does she like lilies? Go with
right.
Those.
Is she an orchid fan? I mean, there are lots of different flowers. Picking the flower that is your wife or sweetheart's favorite is very, very romantic, as opposed to just kind of doing the standard roses, even if that person may not be in love with roses.
More rose lore. You ready? White roses are always a little touch of class. But the roses, actually, historically, a lot of people don't pay attention to this, but the roses historically have meanings to them. So a red rose, the reason we do red roses on Valentine's Day is a red rose signifies passionate love. A white rose signifies pure love. And so the white rose and red rose together, sort of, that's a nice, and it's a little less common, I think. And anytime you put a little effort into something, I think that brings you into the realm of not cheesy on Valentine's Day. Be careful about yellow roses, because yellow roses...
Hold on. I just have to interject about the white rose.
Yeah.
Great place for cheeseburgers at 3 o'clock in the morning.
For the local listening audience, there is a hamburger place that...
3 a.m., just one of those places where a Cali cheese at 3 a.m. is your perfect food.
And that would, giving your Valentine, that would not be romantic.
Not romantic, exactly.
Okay, so white roses are pure love, red roses are passionate love. They make a nice mix. And again, if you call ahead or have roses delivered to the restaurant so they're waiting there, very romantic.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you can also call the restaurant and have a bottle of champagne chilled waiting for you tableside.
Very good idea.
Oh, yeah. You're the king. Right.
Or even home. Don't think that you need to do this at a restaurant. Having a bottle of champagne waiting for whomever to come home, it really is romantic.
And also champagne. A lot of these champagnes come in half bottles. And so to have a half bottle of champagne before you go out, a little quiet romantic glass of champagne, put the kids in the closet and have a champagne. also I recommend to start, if you're going to go out there buying champagne, most champagne is dry and most people think they want a dry champagne. You don't. Okay. To start with champagne, especially if you can do champagne and strawberries or something like that. Believe it or not, what you really want is a champagne with a little bit of sweetness.
And there are some great ones.
And the one that is most commonly available in America and certainly in the New York metro area is made by Veuve Clicquot. We commonly see the Veuve Clicquot, that funny orange label. It's called Yellow Label Brut.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most common one. But they also make a slightly sweet champagne that you can find, and you can find in half bottles. It's called Demi-Sec.
And ironically, Demi-Sec means half dry. But consider that to mean, let's think of the glasses half full, and that means half sweet.
So, but the demi-sec is a great way to start off, and if you think you like champagne, demi-sec champagne is immediately accessible to anyone. So I recommend that in a half bottle home on the ice before you go out to dinner. Then, of course, I recommend that you come to my place.
but not on Valentine's Day. A different day.
You know, the other thing is, do something quiet at home on Valentine's Day and go out for a Friday night after or tonight, the Wednesday night before. It's a little spontaneous. It mixes it up, and you're probably going to go to a restaurant that's less crazy.
Well, you're
going to
get better service. The food will probably be just as good. And you won't be in a massively crowded restaurant because, to me, I think it's more romantic to be in a kind of a quiet little corner in a restaurant. It's hard to get that quiet little corner in a day where everybody's out to dinner.
I always find it kind of sweet when the restaurants are full, as long as they're my restaurant. But we'd love to see you on Sunday as well, and you can get a less crowded experience. My final note on the roses, we told you about red roses and white roses, but yellow roses can be the roses of friendship. But they can also be roses that historically have meant diminishing love. So don't give anybody yellow roses. And pink roses are what you give a 9-year-old girl. Other than that, just no reason.
And carnations, never, never, never.
Unless you're 7. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:16.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Today we have on the show Simon Hopkinson. He was the founding chef at Bibendum in London, one of the great restaurants of London. He was also a food writer for The Independent. His book, Roast Chicken and Other Stories, was written in 94, and then in 2005 was called one of the most useful cookbooks of all time by a prestigious panel of chefs, food writers, and consumers, and it's just become available in the United States.
Simon, welcome to the show.
Hi.
We love your book, man.
Thank you very much.
But we're not alone. Lots of people love your book.
That's very kind of you to say.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We talk to a lot of people who write cookbooks and novels about food and all sorts of nonfiction about food as well. Why this book has had an interesting life. Why don't you tell us about it from its inception? From 94, it came out and did reasonably well, and then in 05, new life was breathed into it, and now it's just coming to America now. Can you tell us the story of this book?
Well, I just wanted to write a cookery book. I've been in restaurants all my life. I was many, many years ago, at the end of the 70s, a restaurant inspector for a guidebook called Egon Rone. But apart from doing that, which made me very fat in the end, eating in restaurants twice a day for about 2.5 years. But otherwise, I'd been cooking and been in restaurants. But I actually did want to do a recipe book, a cookery book, which, although there was a lot of influence from restaurants that I'd worked in, and there are recipes in there from, you know, with memories of places I'd worked, but essentially I wanted it to be a cookery book written by, I suppose you could say, a professional cook, but that was, something that would be just nice to cook at home. It's just about cooking, really.
It's a very consumer-friendly book.
Oh, thanks. Good.
Well, now, but...
Oh, go on.
I was just going to say, now, was it a surprise to you in 05 when it sort of got this second life because it was named the best cookbook of all time and the most useful cookbook of all time?
Well, useful was the word, not best. I just don't think that's possible. I like useful, obviously. Anything that's positive is nice, but... It was the best description I could hope for, because useful recipes aren't easy to come across, I guess. In terms of whether you say useful or user friendly, I think a curious word, but I mean I want to entice people to cook. I want to say how lovely it is, and really all I'm concerned about is talking about the food, hopefully giving you an accurate recipe, but that you look forward to eating it. And I think sometimes there are recipes which maybe could be seen as not looking at the end result. You know, I really want to eat that. That's what I'm all about.
You said that, I've read quotes where you've been quoted as saying that. You know, there's not enough love of the food sometimes in the fancy cuisines of today, and we've talked about some great chefs at the forefront of great restaurants across the world, and you said, you know, there's not enough love of eating there.
I think there is that. How can I put it? You look at a dish and you think this is actually ingredients put together, rather than being something composed, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
It'll be chicken or guinea fowl or a piece of bass or something like that with something else, and they become sort of components that not necessarily, I feel, don't complement each other.
More sizzle than substance.
Pardon?
More sizzle than substance.
That's not a bad way of putting it. You know, you look at a plate of food and you'll think, this is this. And I'm not good about these sort of dribbles and smears and then towers. And when you look at a dish, sometimes you think, well, you see it on the menu, you think, oh, I'll have that. And then it comes and it's nothing like what you expected. And there'll be, sorry, that's my cat. if you can hear that in the background. I've lost my thread now.
You were saying that food is more of a conceit than actually an organic thing that works together, a list of ingredients.
Yeah, I mean, let's take a perfect example, something like a great coq au vin, where you've got a wonderful chicken and you've got a fruity red wine, a burgundy, and you've got the components of mushrooms, little onions, and bacon, which, and it's braised over a couple of hours, and it's perfect. You know, it's... Whoever created that, of course, is a genius, and nobody's ever going to be able to really do something like that again.
I think we're saying that's more a single thing. It becomes a single thing rather than remaining a component.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, you know, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll come right back and talk more with Simon Hopkinson. His book, just available in the United States, Roast Chicken and Other Stories, has just become available, and it's been called the most useful cookbook ever written. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're talking with Simon Hopkinson. His book is Roast Chicken and Other Stories. It's been called the most useful cookbook of all time. So, Simon, why did you call the book Roast Chicken?
Well, it really is one of my most favorite things to cook and to eat. Whether it's a traditional English roast chicken with bread sauce and little sausage and bacon rolls and roast potatoes, or it's a more French sort of thing with plenty of butter and a bit of garlic and lemon juice. And
okay, you named like five ingredients there that make everything better. You said butter, you said sausage, you said bacon, you said garlic. I mean, are those things make any food taste good?
They do. They really do. And you know, you get a good chicken and that lovely crisp skin and lots of basting with the butter and letting it rest and carving it, and I mean, it's pretty delicious, isn't it? It's coming up to lunchtime over there.
Indeed, it is.
Well, now I want to ask you, because I think roast chicken was the perfect title for this book because it is sort of the central basic meal. That in a way it's really simple, and one of the things I find about a roast chicken is it's a fairly easy dish not to screw up, but you have to have some talent to make it perfectly. And when it's perfectly, when anybody can make an okay roast chicken, but when it's done perfectly, it's sublime.
So you've got to. I mean, with all good cooking, you've got to want to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that you've got to attend to it. You've got to attend upon it, and not just bung it in the oven and forget about it. It's something that is a loving thing to do.
Simon, we're going to listen to the news right now, but I hope you'll stay with us to talk about your book and the way it's structured and the way you've done your recipes, because they're a little different than most cookbooks. Will you stick with us? Terrific. We'll be back after the news talking more with Simon Hopkinson about the most useful cookbook of all time, Roast Chicken and Other Stories, available. You can find out about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Now the news, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Simon Hopkinson is a famous chef and author from England. He's won awards for both his cooking and his writing. His book, Roast Chicken and Other Stories, has been called the most useful cookbook of all time, and it's just been published in the United States. Simon, we were talking before the break about, or I alluded before the break, to the fact that you've written your recipes in a different format than most of the cookbooks we see here, which I would say most of the cookbooks we see here are like a list of ingredients and then a list of steps, and then it's on to the next thing. Talk
right.
to us about how you instruct people to make food.
Well, I think it's the way I like to read a recipe myself is certainly a bit of chat before the recipe itself, which I think you'll find pretty well throughout roast chicken, and to tell you a bit about the dish and perhaps a bit of history or who influenced me with it or that sort of thing, it's provenance, let's say, and then the list of ingredients, hopefully in the right order. I'm quite good at that, I think. I mean, somebody taught me about it, and I like to adhere to, you know, using them in the right order, and then instructions with perhaps some notes as to why this dish will be better if you do it in a certain way or it won't if you don't. I do believe in certain way of doing things.
Well, now this book, I just wanted to point out that this book was written in 1994?
1994, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the whole idea of contextualizing a recipe, all the cookbooks today, sort of there's a story attendant upon them, but that's a phenomenon that's really come to the fore in maybe the last 6 or 7 years. Your book, it was very unusual at the time to write a cookbook in this way, which is more than just a list of recipes. What inspired you to do it in a different way?
I suppose I didn't think of it like that. I suppose I just did what first of all, I did want to do it ingredient-led, my favorite things. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a lot of things which may not necessarily appeal to a lot of people in some respects. There's quite a lot of offal in the book, or I think you call variety meats. But I just wanted to enthuse about my favorite things. I mean, if I could have called it my favorite things, because that's really what the book is about. You know, I can't write a recipe book. I don't think anybody can write a recipe book about things they don't want to eat. I know it may sound a sort of an obvious thing to say, but that is what the book is about.
Well, now,
one of the things that in this book that I think appeals to people, here in this country especially, we have a lot of the glamour chefs writing cookbooks that are basically meant to be beautiful picture books for your coffee table. They're not really meant to be cooked out of. The ingredients are very hard to find. The steps are very, very difficult to follow. You'd pretty much have to be a professional chef.
Yeah, there's a lot of that sort of thing. When you get halfway through a recipe, then you suddenly find you've got to make 2 pints of veal stock, and you have to go to the back of the book, that sort of thing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, either that or that, I look at recipe books, and I have Alain Ducasse's cookbook, and I have a lot of these wonderful cookbooks, and they're fascinating and interesting. But it's my suspicion, and I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing, but it's my suspicion that most of those large coffee table books, just by their very format, being large coffee table books that would be inconvenient to have open on your counter in the kitchen while you're trying to cook, are sort of destined to be thumbed through and leafed through and read, which I think has some value, but they're not really meant to be cooked from.
No, I think a good cookbook should get filthy.
Yeah,
exactly.
Or you have two copies, one to keep nice and one to cook from, and... I do think that's a sign of a good cookbook if it's got lots of smears on it.
I get kind of nostalgic when, you know, I open up my mother's, you know, roast chicken recipe and there's some splattering of gravy or something in on that page. You know, it's I know it's real.
Yeah, pages stuck together. It's a good thing.
Now, with Roast Chicken and Other Stories, It's been a heck of a ride. I mean, now you're not cooking in a kitchen anymore.
No, I stopped. In fact, just after, at the end of 94, I stepped back from the stove and decided that I did really enjoy writing. I'm still connected with Bibendum, but I don't cook in the kitchen. I go and eat there and enjoy it very much. In fact, I went for lunch on Sunday and had most wonderful roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. which has been on the menu for 21 years now.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
21 years old in November. And it's always on Sunday lunch and with freshly homemade, fresh homemade horseradish, which really goes up your nose. You know what I mean?
I absolutely know the one. If it doesn't go up your nose, it's not really worth having horseradish.
No, exactly.
Now, the book itself has had, you know, it's two lives, and if it does as well as you hope, and frankly it deserves in the United States, that'll be yet a third reincarnation of the book. You can't kill this damn thing. But it must be very surprising for you. I read that when the book was called, now it was written in 1994, and then in 1905, when Waitrose Food Illustrated put a panel of chefs together, they called it the most useful cookbook of all times. You, for a time, outsold Harry Potter.
On Amazon UK, yes, I think I did.
I was
in France when this all happened.
I mean, that's got to be very interesting. Did you have any suspicion that it had this book faded into the recesses of your memory, and then all of a sudden it's relevant to your life again, and you're coming on radio shows across the Atlantic Ocean?
I know, it's very exciting. I'm very pleased to be on, by the way. Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course.
But it is very exciting. I'm pretty sure that I did one called Second Helpings, which hopefully is coming out in the fall with you. I did a Second Helpings, a roast chicken book, which hopefully will, as I say, coming out in the fall, so I understand.
Well, we'll have to have you on for a second helping of
Simon
on the show.
it's lovely. I mean, it 11 years on, and then suddenly it did go wild. It was I like to say a little bit self-deprecatingly that it was it happened around the end of July, beginning of August of 2005, and there wasn't. Perhaps it was a quiet time for news.
I don't think it's just that. I also think that there are some timing issues here. Here in the United States, people are starting to look at their food a little bit more closely. Mm-hmm. And there is definitely some, let's go back to the classics. Let's go back to some of those great recipes that just really, really taste wonderfully.
Well, you know, I think that I can't speak to what's happening in England at all, but what's I think is going on here is that people are still love to go out to restaurants, and there is a breed of cook who, you know, maybe didn't learn how to cook from their mother or their father, but who has gotten into cooking, and you know will occasionally once a week do the grand sort of large project of cooking to create the thing to show off. They love to cook, and they have the time, and they'll do that on a Saturday or a Sunday.
Yeah.
But I think more and more people are trying to buy locally. The success of Whole Foods here in the United States is an example of that. But, you know, if you go and buy those Whole Foods, yes, you can buy the prepared foods there, but I think the whole idea is, well, okay, now I've bought a bunch of rutabagas and some beets and some horseradish. What the heck do I do with them on a Tuesday night? That's not going to take, you know, 9 pans, 7 hours, and destroy my kitchen.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I think that, you know, roast chicken is what you would have on a Tuesday night.
Yeah, any night of the week. I mean, it's or a little bit of calf's liver and some bacon and some delicious mashed potatoes or something like that. It's not all the recipe for the Venetian style calf's liver. You know, you just fry it up with little squares of it with onions, and it takes minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's not difficult.
And it's
a very nice thing to do.
And I think that's what people are doing, is they're trying to incorporate cooking back into their everyday life as much as they can. And a book like this is really helpful. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk more with Simon Hopkinson about his book, Roast Chicken and Other Stories. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:45. I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Simon Hopkinson. His book, Roast Chicken and Other Stories, has been called the most useful cookbook of all time. He's been a chef and a writer about food for many years. Simon, I know that you started your cooking career. You said at the beginning of the show you've been in restaurants your whole life. And so you started in a sort of a classic European apprenticeship at La Normandie. Is that correct?
I did.
Now, I really want to talk to you about this because more and more often the subject of culinary school comes up as we're talking about culinary schools in the United States. And I don't know what's going on in England, but we operate a couple of restaurants. And I see a lot of young people coming out of culinary school, some very good culinary schools. But some people come out of culinary school after a two-year or year-and-a-half program with some basic skills and are $10,000 or $15,000 in debt. And some young people come out of culinary school after a two- or four-year program at some more prestigious culinary schools,
$80,000, $150,000
in debt. You know, I find that very interesting in a trade that I think may best be learned by apprenticeship. Can you talk to us about how you learned about food and your life in restaurants?
Well, I mean, I have to mention my parents because they, although my father was a dentist and my mother taught, they were very interested in food. And so I had a sort of healthy greed for good eating from a very early age. And it wasn't anything necessarily exciting, but they inspired me to cook without question. But you know, and I went off to in school holidays. I went off to work in the Normandy for I think two or maybe three school holidays before taking it up full time. And I think the expression apprentice. I don't know what it is with you, but that word has sort of disappeared. I mean, they now all want to. Everybody wants to run before they can walk, really, and I think the famous chef thing is sometimes not necessarily a good thing because you need to learn a great deal before you really get yourself going.
You know what I think is interesting though is that a lot of the most famous chefs in the world were people who came up through apprenticing in various restaurants,
yeah.
And yet we have young people who aspire to follow in their footsteps and hope to make, you know, $500,000 a year with a cooking show, yet they figure they can go to a 2 or 4 year culinary school and come out and, you know, what's sad, they're showing statistics more and more than people come out of a full culinary school with a lot of debt. Something
right.
like 4 out of 5 of them aren't cooking 5 years out of culinary school because they just can't afford to do it.
Right.
You know. Do you have this culinary school thing in England as well or no?
I mean, we do have some, but I think they're much more prevalent in the States. I think that the young aspiring cooks tend to go straight into kitchens more than anything else. I mean. I'm not absolutely sure because I never went to one.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Is the television chef as big a phenomenon in England as it is over here?
Oh, yes.
I mean, obviously Jamie Oliver is all over the place there.
Yes, and Gordon Ramsay. And
Well, now, talk to us about the celebrity chefs and the kind of foods that they're cooking. And now, you've cooked professionally in a restaurant. You were a very well-regarded chef. You've been a very well-regarded food writer for many years. And you were even a reviewer for a well-regarded publication. So that gives you a lot of different perspectives on food. Why don't you talk to us about the kind of food that you're seeing at the forefront of contemporary European cuisine or contemporary American cuisine today?
I'm very old-fashioned. I mean... For instance, I haven't been to New York since 2001, but an abiding memory is the Four Seasons, you know, which has been there since 1959, the wonderful Four Seasons in Manhattan. And they still do a wonderful Caesar salad, at least they did the last time I was there. I think that when you find something perfectly done, I think it's the most wonderful thing. You go back for something, and it's exactly how you imagine it should be. It's made properly. It's made table side. It's made from scratch in a wooden salad bowl, and it's perfect. And there's no bits of chicken in it. There's no bits of bacon. It's got the croutons. It's got the parmesan. It's got the cobbled egg. It's got the good olive oil and all those sort of things. And I think those sort of things are starting to disappear. And I would say that in terms of of restaurant dishes that that appeal are few and far between for me these days.
You know, I think sometimes what we see is a chef is so inclined to put his own personal stamp on a dish
and to do something new.
That it becomes less important to make it better.
It's Fabian bathwater.
Yeah, right. Sure. Throw the baby with the bathwater. Well, you know what? But I do think, and I think this is one of the reasons that your book is popular. You know, we in the United States have really had a culinary awakening in the last 20 years. I mean, the 70s were like the nadir of good food in the United States. Everything was out of a can or a box or the frozen food aisle. And we've turned, for a while there, it always needed to be the new thing. And I think in many ways in the field of molecular gastronomy, people are still striving for the new thing. But I think more and more people are looking for the new thing to be just the change of the seasons, you know, and for things to come and go with the seasons.
Yeah.
And hopefully, one of the reasons people are looking for your book is that's enough. I don't need to do something that's never been done before. I don't need to reinvent food.
No. And it's wonderful to wait for something. I mean, why... You don't want strawberries all year round, and you think, oh, and asparagus is coming in, and I mean we have these problems here where there's asparagus in my local supermarket from Peru at the moment, and why do you want it?
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. I think it tunes you better with life, and I think your book will help people to figure out what to do with all this local produce that we can find. And I want to thank you for coming on the show. The book is great, and it's been a great deal of fun talking with you.
Thanks, Simon.
It's been a pleasure.
Super. Well, the book, again, is Roast Chicken and Other Stories. It's been called the most useful cookbook of all time, just available in the United States. You can find out more about it at our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. I'll tell you, this book, Roast Chicken and Other Stories from Hopkinson, I really like, and I like what he... actually, he seems like a very nice guy.
He does.
I'd like to hang out with him, but he's very far away. But you were talking, Mark, about acquiring basic skills.
Yeah, we had Grant Achatz on the show a while back, probably almost a year ago, molecular gastronomy at the forefront in Chicago, doing his thing. And one of the things that Grant talked about was... You can't even begin to talk about experimenting with molecular gastronomy until you understand the true basics of how food gets put together. Until you understand the true, we'll call it a science, but it's more than a science.
It's a feel.
It's
you get
right.
A feel.
You have to really understand how ingredients interact with each other, how flavor profiles change, how they're appealing, what's not appealing.
And how things act in a pan and how mm-hmm. things act in different pans. And it comes from being in there and cooking. And you know what I like about these recipes are these are just the kind of recipes that give you your basic skills. Because, frankly, if you buy a cookbook or you follow a recipe of a very complex dish that's very, you got to do a million different steps and pull it off perfectly, that's an interesting exercise. But if you haven't mastered how to roast a chicken, how to mm-hmm. make scrambled eggs, how to make an onion tart, then you still don't have the basic skills. You may have been able to navigate that recipe, but you don't understand all the steps. When you know how to roast a chicken, cook something in a cast iron pot, mm-hmm. know how to handle an egg properly, these are things that you do, 30, 40, 50, 100 times, and those are skills that serve you well in everything you do.
At Stage Left, we're always trying to present something new, something a little bit different at one of our two restaurants. We're always trying to give you something you would never make at home. That's kind of the idea behind the restaurant.
But then you have to pay us.
Right. But what is wonderful, I think, there is such a thing as a perfect recipe.
Mm-hmm.
There is such a thing as a classic that's become a classic for a reason. And we shouldn't shun those.
And the perfect recipes are recipes like the roast chicken and the Caesar mm-hmm. salad. And those inform the rest of your cooking. Once you've finished that complicated thing, I don't know, it doesn't give you the skills to do anything but follow the complicated thing. Anyway, I hope you like. Check out the book. I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. We certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.